Welcome to the Atonicast. I'm one of your hosts, Alex Roy, and with us, as usual, is the brilliant and fascinating Ed Niedermeyer. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing just fine.
And with us, of course, is the really brilliant Kirsten Korosek.
Hey there. Hello.
And on this very special holiday episode, we are going to talk about my visit to the Florida Automated Vehicles Summit, which, for anyone who's not been to such a summit, usually these events are filled with a lot of Kool-Aid drinking mobility, quote unquote, experts. But this event was different. And I got the opportunity to hang out with the host of the event, State Senator Jeff Brandis. Ed, you've met Senator Brandis, haven't you?
Yeah, you and he and I and a few other people enjoyed a really fascinating dinner after the Autonomous Vehicle Symposium in San Francisco.
Actually, I wasn't there. You were there.
Oh, that's right. You weren't there. Yeah. I'm sorry. What made
this event so...
You were there in spirit, Alex. In spirit.
You're so memorable, Alex, that we just insert you in dinner parties.
Well, that's great. But what's so interesting about Senator Brandis and this particular event is that, you know, he was one of the first state officials to pass an autonomous vehicle law. And so, you know, you've got these states, primarily southern states, you know, good weather states, which have been a lot more open in attracting development and, you know, prototype vehicles and getting them on the ground. Obviously, you've got Waymo in Arizona. And so Brandis is an interesting character because this was one of the first bills, you know, he brought to the state Senate floor. And people thought he was crazy. You know, he's a freshman state senator. And he said, look, we need to get ahead of this. Let's see if there's anything going on here. And this is already a couple of years ago. So Brandis was in the 101st Airborne, I think, and he was in logistics. So he has a lot of experience in moving boxes and is really, really interested not only in kind of efficiency and safety, but the jobs component. And he's a Republican. But on this particular issue, his views – you know, dovetail, you know, with the views of even a little bit of Maya Rockeymoore, whom we interviewed a few months ago on the Atonicast. Like, how can we deploy these vehicles not in a way that doesn't just improve safety and efficiency, but addresses, you know, jobs? So this Automated Vehicle Summit had a really great cross section of speakers. So we had Riley Brennan, who was an investor in Starsky Robotics, and Stefan, the CEO of Starsky Robotics, was there. There was also Alden, I can't remember his exact name, who's the head of self-driving trucks for Uber. And also Mike Scrudato from Munich Re Insurance Company. And a gentleman from KPMG, I'm trying to find his name. Gary Silberg. You know, I'm a big skeptic about the big consultancies offering any insight. But Silberg gave a fascinating talk about their, I guess, projections for self-driving truck and car penetration versus human driving. And so, you know, in light of all the manufacturers and so many of the mobility experts talking about this tipping point, even Bob Lutz saying there'd be this huge tipping point, you know, KPMG had a really well-researched presentation where they were showing the transportation ecosystem 5 and 10 years out, and it was very, very mixed. Now, there were a lot of human-driven cars on the road, and they didn't seem to see a tipping point coming for a long, long time. I didn't get a chance to screenshot that, but I hope that KPMG will make that presentation public because it's something that we should dissect in greater detail on a future episode.
Well, I think that they're going to be actually at Automobility LA, so maybe they'll make the same presentation again. And that's coming up post-Thanksgiving. And we'll be there.
I hope so. Because this is one of the first times I'd seen any major consultancy say anything that wasn't stupid.
You're right, too, in that these conferences really do tend to often devolve into sort of a Kool-Aid drinking contest, right?
You know, I love to call people out, but I'd rather not do so directly. You know, we all get invited to a lot of conferences, and they can be expensive, and it's a hassle. And you've got the same talking heads just blurbing the same spiel. But what are these conferences really for? They're really for, you know, government officials to figure out what's going to work, whether or not they should, you know, buy into these technologies. You've got venture capitalists looking to make investments. And then you've just got these guys saying, it's coming, it's going to come, you should invest. in a sea of startups. I mean, I think we all agree there's a bubble. It's got to blow up sooner or later. Who to invest in? I mean, a big question that came up at this conference was whether or not these cities and towns should invest in Vita X, you know, Vita I, you know, solutions, and whether autonomous vehicles needed infrastructure to function. I personally think that if an autonomous vehicle requires infrastructure outside of the vehicle itself, it's not a good thing.
Most autonomous vehicle developers take that approach, right? Where it would be nice to have Vita X, but they're not relying on it for their core design.
No. And there was a guy from Toyota, not from TRI, Toyota Research Institute, but a guy from Toyota, Japan, who was talking about how much infrastructure they were putting on the ground there. But you have a completely different, you know, political, cultural climate where it's not that difficult to, or at least it's easier than it is in the United States, to have a single solution deployed, you know, universally.
Right. Well, don't you think that that sort of solution would be helpful when you have a mix of cars and self-driving cars and really not as, it's so not so much a requirement like Ed mentioned, where self-driving car developers are sort of moving beyond that. They're just doing their own thing, even though there's this like call to do it. To me, when we are in this point where our cities are mixed with regular human drivers and also self-driving car pilot programs or geofenced, that's when it would become more handy than one or the other. Does that make sense?
I don't think it's ever going to be useful, because unless it's ubiquitous and has 100% uptime, you know, if the system goes down, then the self-driving cars have to kick back to onboard logic or, you know, onboard systems. So, and those systems have to work anyway. So I think the cars have to work independently of any infrastructure, in my opinion, and anything else is just going to be a kludge. And all of this presupposes that the budgets are there to build the infrastructure and maintain it. And we can't maintain the infrastructure we have now.
Right.
So there are real political issues standing in the way of getting this infrastructure off the ground as well. And obviously the telecom business wants the spectrum that was sort of designated for Vita X. And it just seems to me like people who develop new technology do not like to have a sort of knot hole for their projects that they don't control. You know, it's one thing, you know, they can solve a technological problem. It's not quite as easy to solve politics.
If you were to look in my email inbox right now, there's at least 20 people pitching me stories that would really disagree, and they think it's the most important thing.
Ugh, gag me.
So what is their argument?
I mean, I think that a lot of it comes down to these are startups in and around the space, or they're analysts who want to talk about the importance of it and just want to inject themselves in stories that they think will be topical. But basically the exact opposite argument that you're making. that's an important key infrastructure to have, is, you know, and I'm not saying I agree with that at all. It's really interesting to see, like, there almost is emotional, you know, argument going on and I'm not really sure what's driving it, quite honestly.
Well, obviously profits, because it doesn't matter whether the, you know, infrastructure is necessary or even works. If you've got the contract with government contract to build it out, you've got 10 years of revenue, even if the thing never works. Because once the money's invested, it's like the F-35 program. They've already committed hundreds of millions or billions. If it doesn't work, they can't throw it out. You got to keep going.
I'm really interested in watching what happens with the smart cities. I believe it was Columbus, Ohio that won that about 2 years ago. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
Vaguely.
Yeah, it was. I'm pretty sure that they won it. Basically, it was this government-sponsored, but also sort of a quasi-public-private competition in a way. And it was really an exercise to get cities to start thinking about the future. And Columbus was picked as the winner. They had the most compelling application. But I'm really curious to see how they play around with things like Vita X and if they even bother going down that road. So what they're going to be doing is working with companies on the infrastructure side and also the companies that might be using future transport or deploying future transportation options and things like that, instead of remodeling the city. So I want to see what they do, and it'll be interesting to see if they like completely bypass that and they end up with something else. It could end up being the model for other cities, or maybe they'll do it and it'll be a giant mistake and we'll all learn from it.
You know who came by? There was someone from 3M came and did a presentation about how even very basic, low-cost upgrades to roads would profoundly improve just ADAS systems. So the standardization of reflective paint and marking types and road signage would yield much bigger benefits in the near and midterm that are real, you know, and we all know, I mean, you're driving, you've both driven Teslas, is that the quality of autopilot depends enormously on the road signage and on the lane markings. And that's a lot cheaper than smart cities and like tech in the ground.
Putting a bunch of tech in the ground that like, we don't even know who would maintain it, fix it, deal with all the damage that happens to like regular infrastructure now. I mean, like, look at just our bridges. And to make that gigantic leap and say that now we're going to put all this tech in our infrastructure when we have bridges falling apart, I just think is like completely missing.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I think a lot of people forget about sort of the history of cars is that, you know, back when cars were the new hot technology and, you know, the Model T was really popularizing it and they were really starting to take over society, there was actually a real understanding that it was really important for people who use this new technology would pay for the infrastructure. I feel like in our modern political context, this is super bizarre, but like the charge for a gas tax was led by AAA, the American Automobile Association. And it's because you needed infrastructure in order to really have this new technology work properly. And really the boom of the car industry in the first half of the 20th century was like one of the major economic drivers globally, but certainly in the US. And one of the things that made that happen was the fact that the businesses and the consumers, both sides, were willing to spend money, pay taxes in order to create the infrastructure that was necessary. You know, technology has come a long way, but I feel like socially, politically, if anything, we may have regressed. In fact, frankly, I mean, you see a lot of debates over electric cars, whether they should pay a special tax because they're not paying a gas tax, which is what pays for infrastructure. So I think that our political and sort of social culture needs to look back at the early days of cars in order to understand like what works, you know, to in terms of fostering new technologies. And it's not just, it can't just be a race to the bottom in terms of regulations. There has to be actual investments in infrastructure to make this stuff work.
Ed, did you just recommend that the public take a reflective, thoughtful look back at our history and then make assessments from that and then proceed forward? Because I feel like that's just a huge ask.
Yeah,
but please go ahead.
No, that's your point is well made.
Go ahead.
Can't even get people to remember things Tesla said 5 years ago. I don't think we're going to get people to remember the things that helped make automobiles, you know, one of the cornerstones of our society.
But this is a safe place, so we can dream and we can talk about those things. So go ahead, Alex.
Over and over at many conferences, you hear people talk about safety, safety, safety. But we all know that no one really cares about safety. No one cares. You're selling people that on the idea that they'll be safer in cars they don't control, and they also should have their taxes raised to pay for it. That's a no-go. I mean, that's never going to happen. People won't really pay for their own safety today because they, you know, could go to Skip Barber or driving school but they're fine paying for it on an individual level, but not on a collective level. Sad to see it. Several people in the audience asked about the effect of, you know, self-driving trucks on jobs. You know, Riley Brennan got up and talked about Starsky. You know, Starsky solution is this, is teleoperation of trucks from A to B and Y to Z. So truckers will no longer have to stay, well, get in the trucks. They can stay home or close to home and remotely control the trucks. And then the trucks will drive themselves from B to Y. So I asked Stefan how that would work, what kind of connections they'd have. And he seemed to think that twin cellular connections were sufficient to control the trucks at the start and end points. And that if for any reason the truck had a problem or lost connectivity on the road, it would just pull itself over. Now, okay, you know, it's a position. Whether it's right or wrong is, you know, worthy of debate. Riley seems to think it'll make sense. The audience was curious. And then it was Uber's turn, and they had the head of Uber self-driving trucks got up, and they asked him, "Well, what's your solution to, you know, jobs?" And they pulled out this really entertaining video, which showed functionality called Take Me Home, whereby a trucker is still in the truck on the road far from home, and he misses his family. So he presses a button on the Uber Freight app, and his next route will take him home and with freight, which is, I guess, an efficiency solution, but doesn't solve the same set of problems and doesn't address the issue of self-driving trucks at all. And so that was a big letdown. And afterwards, you know, the audience, they were discussing the merits of the Starsky approach, but they were completely dumbfounded by the lack of an answer from Uber. And I was dumbfounded too.
There's so much focus on the truck driver, which I think is absolutely important. But like, it seems like we're forgetting that like companies are involved here. And they're going to have the ones that are dictating what they want to have happen. So I just don't understand why Uber would spend any time on that feature.
If you spend enough time with Stefan, you know, his position is, look, we shouldn't even necessarily try to change the way trucking companies do business. Let's give them a solution that allows them to do business more efficiently and that addresses the driver, you know, complaints, which is far from home. So teleoperation, assuming it can be made to work, makes some sense. And his other answer would be, look, there's a shortage of truck drivers, and we're in fact already delivering freight today. Whereas Uber, it just feels like they are building solutions hoping that they'll get adopted and they're piecemeal. It just feels like a lot of money was spent without a plan, or and that there's no real plan in the absence of self-driving in the near term. So that was the conversation in the hallway, you know, pretty much the rest of the day for anyone who's cared about the truck component. But really, really impressed by the guy from the American Center for Mobility and their efforts to build this facility in Ypsilanti. And they've raised $10 million. I forget the exact number.
This is the facility in Michigan, correct?
That's correct.
There are several though, right? This is not M City, is it?
No, it's not M City. We've talked on the Tonicast forever about the lack of real testing of ADAS features. And then eventually with, you know, level 4, how would you test that? How would you define safety? So the ACM guys wanted to basically break down each of the subcomponents and test those. Today, the only tests that are going on for, say, an automatic emergency braking system are done by NHTSA and the International Institute for Highway Safety, which is
insurance institutes.
Yeah, IHS. So that's a consortium of insurance companies. And they do this AEB testing at different speeds, but they're low speeds and don't address behavioral aspects of how AEB integrates with, you know, radar cruise control. And we've all driven Teslas, and we know that the behavior of Tesla and autopilot has changed over time. And we know that each manufacturer's deployment of the same technology on paper is behaviorally different. And a driver who gets into one car and becomes familiar with how that will behave, gets into a different vehicle, will be surprised, and maybe in a very bad way, about the behavior of that car. Because your expectation is that the car will always brake under certain circumstances, and a different vehicle doesn't, is a problem. So the ACM guys are making what appeared to me to be a very good effort to resolve this. You know, last year I had this fantasy that I would create such a facility. I'm glad I didn't, because I didn't even think as far as they did. And they've got, you know, big support behind them. I was relieved to see someone doing that.
I want to know what your dream facility would have like even entailed and what it would have been called. Did you get that far?
It was probably 1/4 of what the ACM guys have in mind. But one component, which I think was absolutely necessary, would be a thing like the Nürburgring, but for self-driving cars, or, you know, even ADAS vehicles. Because the Nürburgring, for anyone who doesn't know what the Nürburgring is, it's a track in Germany built in the 30s, which manufacturers use to demonstrate the capabilities of their cars. So every manufacturer in the world brings a car there and declares a lap time. And your Nürburgring lap time is kind of a mark of achievement. And the Nürburgring has just this astronomical number of complex turns and switchbacks. The back section is called the Green Hell. It's a really complex track. And if you're in the sports car business, I guess it is the ultimate measure of what the car can do. It's absolutely useless as a demonstration of what a passenger car can do, but for sports cars, it's everything. And I think we need something like an Autonoring. And I think it needs to be actually in the real world. Last year, I went with the Drive show for NBC Sports, and we took a, you know, this Mercedes E-Class and a Tesla Model S from San Francisco to Sonoma and then around the East Bay and back across the Bay Bridge to, you know, test the vehicle's ADAS in, you know, three different environments. And it was really fascinating. I'm not sure how the California DOT would have felt about that if they had known what we were doing. But ultimately, a track will never be able to simulate all the conditions of the real world. And there needs to be a real world test with metrics, like a point system, something better. And so the ACM is, I think, a big step in the right direction.
Do you feel like you can achieve that also in like simulation models too, as a way to validate?
If you can do simulation on level 4, but if you try to simulate ADAS, the one thing you cannot simulate well or ever, I think, is the driver's reaction to what ADAS is doing. If you're in a self-driving car, the passengers have no expectation of input into, you know, car behavior. They're either safe in their minds or they're not. But with an ADAS-equipped vehicle, I know that in Teslas over time, and certainly in the Mercedes, which is a terrible system, that I would react and sometimes overreact to what I perceive to be the car making poor decisions. And then I would intervene. With the first generation Tesla Autopilot, as I became familiar with it, I became much more confident and I was safer. But then Tesla would release an update and I'd have to relearn it. And as we know, they released updates which, you know, removed functionalities. And that's a problem. For an owner, maybe not so much, but for a renter or periodic user, or user of a shared vehicle via a platform like Turo, it's a problem. Anti-lock brakes, everyone assumes they work the same way. And probably today they all do. But traction control systems don't all work the same way. And traction control systems in a BMW intervene at different times, even on different models within the BMW lineup in different ways. And, you know, enthusiast owners complain about this. So as ADAS becomes pervasive, this stuff has to be standardized. And ACM is a step in the right direction. I would say, though, that the ACM guy was deep. His sales tactic to the audience for a product I think is good was wrong. He's talking about road deaths as the method of selling any of this technology is probably not the best method.
I feel like everyone uses that, though. That is the big selling point. And I think, who is it, Dr. Gil Pratt, I've heard a couple times over at the Toyota Research Institute, basically say that even the human condition is such that even if tomorrow we said by having self-driving cars, we could reduce the number of fatalities in the United States by half or by 75%, the first death that would happen within a self-driving car, people would completely like be unable to deal with that because we're a lot more forgiving to ourselves for making mistakes and not technology. So that whole like idea of using that as the metric, I'm not really sure if that's the best, but everyone uses it.
I mean, 99% of people think that they're good drivers, but or better than average, but statistically that's impossible.
Yeah, my problem with it is so cynical. I mean, if people really, you know, it's become very hip to talk about road deaths because of, you know, as a way to promote autonomous technology. And the reality is like how many of these people, you know, are taking the time to, you know, educate themselves to become better drivers in the meantime, right? If you really care about it, you know, the technology is not here yet. It kind of is a really interesting manifestation of what Genny Morozov calls solutionism, which is, you know, where we look to technology to just create easy fixes for problems that actually either don't have an easy fix or that we could, you know, solve on our own. Like I'm doing a terrible job of explaining it at the moment.
I think what you're trying to say is that using the road death metric right now is kind of like the avocado toast.
Do you want to expand on that?
it was always possible to use it, but now suddenly everyone's using it, right? And it's like this new discovery of avocado, smash on toast. It's amazing. No, I was actually just kidding, But I do think that it's a metric that is used all the time and because it's easy for everyone to understand. And so it's become the go-to metric to use. Everyone can understand the sort of fatality metric, right? So that's why it's used.
And, yeah. You know, something they've understood it for 50 years and not taken the cheapest, easiest steps to resolve it. which is why, you know, Tire Rack has, you know, so many different tires because people are willing to save $50 at the expense of their own safety in the wet. And that's why you have, you know, every winter there are deaths because people didn't buy snow tires. It's just, it's outrageous. But, you know, I just wanted to move on to maybe the most interesting guest of the summit was Bryant Walker Smith. Have you guys met him?
Not in person.
I've interviewed him on the phone, but never in person.
Like, what a terrific and entertaining and charismatic person with just the really everyone should be trying to hire him to do like the marketing for their self-driving tech. Not that he would ever do it because he really dug deep into kind of the psychology of people and safety. And he it was really refreshing to hear him come out and do this great presentation about how about what a definition of safety would have to be. And so, you know, he came up and talk about a presentation I hope he makes public. He came up with a list of voluntary commitments that manufacturers should have to make in order to legitimately claim that their systems are safe. I recommend that anyone who hasn't read, you know, his posts and articles do so because he's making a real effort. I guess he and Jim McPherson, our friend, are the are really two most lucid voices about the need to understand what safety really means. It's not a continuum. There's safer and there's less safe, but there's no such thing as safe unless it's 100%. And since it's impossible, manufacturers, companies trying to sell us goods and services that are safer have to make a more compelling case than marketing materials.
And it seems like there's like a macro and a micro approach to safety, right? And like, I think Tesla and some others are saying, like, if we drive, you know, this many billion miles and statistically there's fewer than the average human crashes or fatalities or whatever, that like proves that you're safe. That's very different than looking at it on a micro level and, you know, saying, okay, in this given situation, what is this car going to do to respond to the circumstances in front of it? Testing is a really interesting way to define micro safety, or like this micro approach to safety. And I think that's something that we haven't really seen anyone take a lot of concrete steps towards.
I just want to add that as I was poking around the Florida Automated Vehicle Summit website, they've just posted in the last 24 hours most of the presentations of the speakers. Unfortunately, Bryant Walker Smith's presentation isn't up, but a good portion of what he's talked about is available if you Google him.
We'll include a link to that in the description of this.
Yeah, highly recommend it. And also the 3M presentation about the inexpensive methods of improving infrastructure, the signage and the paint, quite cool. And I should also point out that University of Central Florida had a lot of presence there, and they had a large number of students who were competing, you know, for the best kind of research into self-driving tech. And these kids did just absolutely brilliant and phenomenal job kind of deconstructing, you know, optimization methods for traffic flow, mixed environments of human-driven cars and autonomous vehicles. It was really wonderful to see that this, you know, kind of very young generation of engineering students were doing really great work. And it kind of makes me a little depressed because I meet a lot of young people who are fans of driving or claim to be. And they always ask me, oh, how do I get into cars? Oh my God, I'm really upset. I really want a Ferrari, X, Y, and Z. But they're not interested in learning about the fundamentals of driving safety or what the future of driving is going to look like. I think a lot of those people out there who want to own sports cars in the future, the next generation, don't understand what's going to happen to driving culture. And Florida, as such an open state, is going to be kind of one of these battlegrounds because you don't have a lot of great driving roads, but you have these interstates, and then you have these terrible cities in which to move around during rush hour. And I don't believe anyone understands the culture wars that are going to come about around self-driving cars. There was an article last week in The Week, an op-ed, called Self-Driving Cars Are the New Culture War. 100% true. I assumed if you took a map of gun ownership and voting patterns that people right of center would be against self-driving cars. But Senator Brand has told me the biggest support for bringing in self-driving cars is often in these smaller communities where you have people who vote Republican and own guns. That's kind of ironic. I would have thought it's the opposite.
You know, I think we live in a world now where left and right are no longer homogenous. I mean, they never were really homogenous, but I think in particular, the divisions within these broad divisions politically are becoming more exaggerated. And certainly, you know, libertarians tend to be, especially yeah, more sort of urban cosmopolitan libertarians, tend to be very, obviously very into technology and things like Bitcoin and obviously autonomous cars. And I think that, you know, more rural sort of, you know, social sort of traditionalist conservatives, let's call them, in my experience, are, it's not that they, I don't think they have a problem with autonomous cars existing. Like if people want to develop them, I think they understand that people who live in cities deal with a lot more traffic than they do. And I think what worries them is that they might reach a point where human driving is either banned or like insurance for it is prohibitively expensive. And I think human driving is a very fundamental part of rural culture. And I think it will continue to be.
Part of that, though, has been because there is no other option. And oftentimes, when you own your truck, for example, in rural area, it's a work vehicle. I mean, it's used as a tool, not as just a means of transport.
Let's be real about the fact that a lot of the people who do, who are the most excited about autonomous cars, they, it's not a tool. It's not about being a tool. It's about a status thing, right? It's about signaling that, you know, that you are on the cutting edge of technology, that you appreciate technology, that you, you know, can see the bold future ahead of us. Like I think
right.
a lot of the people, it's fascinating to me that a lot of the people who are most passionate about autonomous cars don't really have a fundamental need for them necessarily.
I see it not so much as where you would be able to chart someone's political leanings with how they feel about self-driving cars, but maybe you can do that today. But ultimately, I believe that there will be a class distinction. Except for the people who are going to be the most common users are going to be the masses and lower economic scale. And then the people who can afford to have a car, it will become like what racehorses are today. And I'm talking like, this is my like prediction for, you know, 50 years from now, is that owning a car will be a luxury.
Kirsten, you just came up with the future episode, which is we should do a whole episode. We talk about science fiction portrayals of future transportation and extract the elements that are accurate or inaccurate based on what we're learning now. If you take what I believe to be true, and I think you two agree, that in the future, any media you consume for free is junk, and anything you pay for is quality. So if you accept the argument that in the future, self-driving cars for the masses will be free in exchange for having to watch advertising while you're in them, the wealthy will be able to pay for the privilege of not having to watch advertising while being transported. Do you guys watch the TV show Black Mirror?
Oh yeah.
I've watched it.
Remember the episode where everyone's, you know, the working class are riding these bikes to earn credits to watch, change channels?
Yep.
And if they don't earn, I kind of see it like that.
Well, and think about it. I mean, what is the ultimate luxury, which is freedom of movement? People with the access to that, to be able to jump in a car and move about and not be on a prescribed route, let's say. You know, if we go to a model in some cities where it's a shuttle system, like an autonomous shuttle system, and you get on and sort of like a bus and you have to, you know, follow this along and there isn't like a lot of, or you're forced to, you know, watch ads. That's not a very freeing experience, but the trade-off is that you get, you know, you get the ride for free. And maybe that's a trade-off that people will accept. But I can see a future, and maybe this will be good for next episode or a future episode, but I definitely see a future where the very wealthiest people, the biggest luxury is that they get to have a manual car still and can go wherever they want.
Using TRI Guardian.
But let's think about the horse example, right? I mean, because yes, horses are now very much associated with the wealthy, you know, the very upper classes in terms of, you know, owning racehorses or breeding them and having these big farms and all this other stuff. But if you think about it, at the opposite end of the spectrum, the very poorest folks who do live rurally also use horses.
But they use it for different things, right? One is
well, exactly. Just, yeah. But that's my point is that I think that manual driving will have that same split, right? Where on the one hand, yes, like the very wealthiest will probably be the only ones who, in my opinion, will be able to insure themselves as human drivers, particularly in cities and certain urban areas. But I think rurally, I think that the manually driven work trucks, like you say, and things like that will also persist in the way that horses sort of have split between sort of the extremes and that folks in the middle are the ones who don't really use horses very much.
Well, but the thing is that horses really, even in very rural areas, I mean, horses are used in cattle, if you're raising cattle on a range to like move your cattle from one leased area, let's say, to another. So there isn't an application really for autonomous vehicle there. But in farmland where you're actually just growing a crop, there is plenty of space for some sort of autonomous vehicle. It just might not be transporting people. It might be doing the job of a tractor without a human driver.
Right. And those are already, I mean, that's already happening, right? I mean,
yeah, that's already happening. Yeah. And that's where I see, honestly, like mining, huge warehouses, agriculture, those are all the places where, to me, I would be betting on to make money immediately in autonomous vehicle tech, because there is a need for it and companies are willing to pay for that. And there already are. I mean, this is all already kind of existing. So, I mean, farmers are going to be using this more and more, but they're still going to maybe get in their F-150 and drive down the supermarket.
Probably be a hybrid F-150, but yeah.
One of the best presentations at the entire event was by a guy named Steve Polzin, and I'm forgetting what organization he's from. His presentation is available, and it went really, really, really deep into why and when we'll start to see transitions. And like the KPMG presenter, talk about how fractured it's going to be and how there won't be like a total tipping point. So Steve Polzin, CUTR is the organization he works for. I have no idea what that acronym stands for.
Nice.
Guys, you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's time to start preparing for the Thanksgiving holiday, I think.
Yep, absolutely. And then the LA Auto Show. And as we've said the last couple episodes, please, if you're going to be at the LA Show, you either have a product or a company that you'd like to try and get on the Autonicast, or if you'd just like to meet up with us and have a beer, please let us know on Twitter. And is there anything else that we should be? Well, I guess this is going to run a little bit later, so they probably aren't pieces yet that we know about to promote at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. For me, I'm beginning my week where I think I mentioned this last show where I take an internet holiday, so. Like this is going to be basically the last thing I do until I see you guys at Automobility LA. So I am working on zero projects currently. I mean, I always have projects, but not in the short term.
Okay. Alex, anything coming up that people should know about?
You go first, Ed.
I got nothing. I'm also finishing up a big project before LA.
Well, I've got pieces coming about how no one cares about safety on a very deep level with deep analysis. And also the concept of peak horse, because you know, people always use the horse analogy. The horse is a terrible analogy. I'm sorry, because at peak horse, which is about 100 years ago, there were actually not that many horses relative to how many cars there are today on the road relative to people.
And people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peak horse. Yeah. We'll talk about that.
Cool. That sounds really interesting. I look forward to reading that. And we look forward to talking again soon about the ever interesting world of autonomous cars. Alex, what's your Twitter handle?
AlexRoy144 on all platforms.
All right. And Kirsten?
I'm at Kirsten Korosak on Twitter.
All right. And I'm at Tweetermeyer. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.